Hello, and thank you for joining us. Another episode of Why Theory. As always, I am your host, Ryan Angley, joined, as always, by co-host Todd McGowan. Todd, how you doing, buddy?
Ryan, I've been better, but I'm gonna. I know that question is meant as you're not supposed to answer it truthfully, but
it's true.
I decided to answer it truthfully.
I
apologize to everyone for answering the question as if I didn't understand what Ryan was really asking, which actually touches on the thing that we're talking about today.
That's a great point.
Because this is one of Slavoj's examples.
This is one of the great examples. So we are today talking about the parallax view, which is, for my money, the blood on the tracks of the Slavoj Žižek. How are you supposed to say ouvre? You're not supposed to say it like that.
Ouvre, right.
Ouvre. There we go.
Yeah, there you go. Tell what you mean by that, because that's pretty, I like your theory here.
Oh, yeah. So I know that, because of Terry Eagleton, there's this thing, I mean, it gets put on the back all these books of Slavoj Žižek, the Elvis of theory. You see this everywhere. And I think he's a lot more the Bob Dylan. And I mean, like, for one, the output, I think, is similar. But there's also, Todd and I have talked about this before, like, starting with, so I think it maps out pretty well. Like, I would say that the times they are changing, that is Sublime Object. And then I think that you could have his thesis be the Bob Dylan, like, the most sublime hysteric, right? Yeah. That was the thesis that he wrote.
Yeah.
That's the eponymous, the debut album from Dylan. And you go from there, and it's just straight bangers for like eight books. And it's the same thing with Dylan up to Blonde on Blonde. Yeah. And then he gets in a motorcycle accident, or he doesn't. It's really interesting if you like really poke at that. It either did happen or it didn't. And he is so funny about it in the Chronicles Volume 1, which was like to be his series of memoirs, of which there is no volume.
There's no volume two, right? I know.
It's amazing. I love that guy so much. Yeah. So anyway, and then so Dylan for me is the person who invents the comeback album. Because he kind of changes genres after Blonde on Blonde, changes his singing voice. You can hear it especially different on Nashville Skyline. And John Wesley Harding, underrated. Love that album. And then he has the Christian period. Anyway, there's a period in the 70s where people were like, Dylan's done. And then he does Blood on the Tracks, and it is like, wow, Dylan's back. And then he goes away again, and then he does Oh Mercy. And everyone's like, wow, Dylan's back. And then it goes away. People don't like the album so much. And then he does Time Out of Mind. It's like, wow, he's back. And then it's the same thing. And then it's like Modern Times. Like, oh, wow, he's back. Okay. So Dylan invents the comeback album, and then he does it like four times. And I think with not that Slavoj's ever gone away exactly. And I don't think that it doesn't map on the same thing, but there are moments in his career where he has these books that I think are major theoretical interventions. And the other Dylan Žižek thing that I would tie is that, like, a lot of people want to dismiss Dylan, whatever. Like, I know I don't care. It's fine if you don't like him. But and I know I like him a lot more than you do.
He's fine. But that's already way.
So they were good. You just say, fate, thank you for agreeing with me. I appreciate you supporting my point. So it's easy to dismiss him because you're like, oh, he just does the same thing, or he sings the same way, or whatever. And it's if you've ever seen him in concert, like especially in the last like 25 years, it is so funny. It's like impossible to tell sometimes like what song he's about to play until like what song he's even playing until he starts singing, because the way he just starts these things in a way that is like deliberately obscure, so like you don't really know. And so if you wanted to dismiss Žižek on the basis that he just kind of says the same thing, that's available to people in the same way that it's this available.
But he also had
Dylan.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Slow Train Coming is kind of like Fragile Absolute, or why the Christian legacy is worth preserving, right?
I love that point by you.
Yeah, yes, he did have this period, right? Like just like Dylan. So I think
Shot of Love. Yeah,
yeah,
the Christian.
So,
yeah.
That's amazing. What's the? I guess can we? Gotta serve somebody. I don't know what that song is. What's the Slavoj version of that song? I don't know.
I don't know. That's
maybe a chapter. Maybe it's his analysis of, because at the end of Fragile Absolute, he has that analysis of Fight Club, you know, the speed Is it Speed, Usual Suspects, and Fight Club? I think that's it. Where the it's or Ransom, maybe, where it's the gesture of shooting at oneself, right? That is
That's
the highlight of that Christian period.
That's awesome.
But I do think that to back to the question meant to not be answered truthfully. I think that that really gets to the heart of this book, Parallax View, because even it is one of the examples, and Slavoj uses that example in other books as well. As a, it's a question that what you're asked, like if you properly understand the question, it's not a question of how you're actually feeling. It's saying, will you enter into a social bond with me? That's what you're really saying.
Yeah.
And I think that's true. I think he's right about that. And I think that that is also really evinces one of the central points of the book, that mediation comes first, right? That first there's this mediating structure or alienating structure. He says that as well. And then there's experience. It's not first you have this this immediate experience and then you're taken away from that. And I think this is one of my, this actually comes to probably my favorite part of this book. It's on page 233 and 234. I'll never forget it.
Nice.
And he says, he's talking about Daniel Dennett. So part of the book is a critique of cognitive science and evolutionary psychology, evolutionary biology, and the way that freedom gets written out of that equation. And we'll talk more about that later. But in his, in the course of the discussion of Dennett, he brings up this difference within continental thinking about there between dialectics and phenomenology. And of course, he's on the side of dialectics. And what he says is that phenomenology believes first there's this original experience and then it gets sedimented with cliche. And he said, and then Slavoj says, no, but dialectics understands that the cliche comes first. Like there are cliches that are, and so this would be an example, right? Like when you're saying, I'm fine, you're just uttering a cliche, but you're, but in a way, there's nothing more original than that. Right. And I think that that's his, to me, that gets at just everything here, because I think that then when you understand that, then you get at this notion that within the, that, 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 that within the mediated structure or within things themselves, there's already this disturbance, right? There's not first this purely pure experience or harmonious structure or harmonious world, anything. First, there is this disturbance, and that's what he calls parallax, which he's, which we should talk about, because he did get this from Kojin Karatani, that this, in a way, this book is a response to Kojin Karatani's trans critique on Kahn and Marx.
Yeah. Yes. So a lot here to set up.
Sorry, I just talked a ton of things. All you know,
it's awesome. We're going to unfurl some of that, and this. Just in a broader sense, this entire year, basically, we've been on this Kant-Lacan kick.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to unfurl the consequences of what, I'll just phrase it in a sentence, the lack of an encounter between Kant and psychoanalysis, and what would there be if there was a greater encounter. And I think this book, so we did our two episodes on Lacan in this trajectory. And then, so now we're here with Žižek, because there's kind of two things going on here. And this is the sort of the this would be my own little meta parallax point, which is the reason why there's, I say this with the greatest love and respect in my heart. The reason why there's this lack of an encounter between Kant and psychoanalysis, it's Žižek's fault.
It's Slavoj's fault.
It's completely his fault.
Yeah.
And I say that with just an immense amount of respect, and not like a blame or shame kind of thing, but it's just the what he was able to do, starting with times they are changing, sublime object of ideology, is to make this connection between Hegel and Lacan and the Hegelian project to the psychoanalytic project, even though Freud is not directly influenced by Hegel, as we've discussed many times, but he's able to show the trajectory of the Hegelian phenomenological project, which is not the phenomenology that Todd just talked about, but this other thing, this to go back to one of the great hapaxes in Seminar 7, the idea of being extimate, you that is more than you, the you that is outside of you, that you have but do not possess. Okay, it is both a part of you and not a part of you. This whole idea, this way of thinking about the mind and the development of thought, that you see this in psychoanalysis, and it's in the German idealist project of Hegel. So Zizek, I mean, people know this because of Slavoj, and he starts that trajectory in Sublime Object. But it's the marriage of Hegel to psychoanalysis has been, too clean. And I want to, and I, the part of this thing is that, like, what happens if there's this affair with Kant? What is that? Right. What does that show? And it can show two things. That there might, it could show many things, but I think my dominant thesis here is you can either go in the direction of someone like Joan Kopchak, who means so much to me and to you, and I know to a lot of other people, where she's showing that, like, no, there's a stable relationship that can be had here, and this is what you get if you do this. Right. And then you have someone like what happens in Parallax View, where what Zizek is showing you is that, like, look, it can't be a stable relationship. Actually, it's just an affair. It's just a tawdry fling. But what it does is it enlightens us about the circumstances about our marriage. And what I'm trying to do with that metaphor is to say that, like, he shows why the Kantian thing doesn't fit, and he explains it especially for him, in painstaking detail. And that's why I did this Dylan thing, because sometimes, you know, it's the same thing in Dylan's career. Just to go back to that, there are these moments where it exceeds everything that he was doing before, even though the stuff that he was doing before was, like, fine, as you said, or even good. But there's something that, like, there's something excessive that, that hits, like, another level. And this is one of those books. Less Than Nothing is another one of those books as well. That's, I think, what you get here, and we want to try to unfurl that, is that there is an encounter with Kant and psychoanalysis here, and it does come from Kojin Karatani. Like, that's the genesis. And what Zizek does is I know you want to explain this a little bit, but for Karatani, parallax is a Kantian concept. And so Zizek removes it from being a Kantian concept to being a Hegelian one, and then shows, I think, in this double way, why the Kantian inflection of the concept cannot fit in psychoanalysis, and why psychoanalysis would need to have the Hegelian one. And I just think, even in this, again, this non-total embrace of Kant, or bringing in Kantian thought into a psychoanalytic thought, we learn something. We learn something that we couldn't if we just kept them apart, and we only went through, like, the further consequences of the Hegelian marriage to psychoanalysis. Yeah. That's sort of my thesis on this, and why we're doing this.
Ryan, that's great. It's really great. I mean, I think that what you're saying about the affair with the revelatory power of the affair with Kant is really good. And I think that what he's saying about his response to Karatani. So Karatani's idea. And you're right that Karatani he's a Kantian Marxist, which is what's interesting is you read Karatani and you realize that everyone says, oh, Marx's real progenitor was Hegel. But if you read Karatani, you're like, no, it's really the pairing is Marx and Kant, and Hegel's this figure that doesn't really fit in. I think that's Karatani's view. And actually, I think that's closer to my view as well, although for the opposite reason of him, because he says that to dismiss Hegel. And I would say that to elevate Hegel. And I think the reason why he is critical of Hegel is that he thinks that Hegel eliminates the parallax. Like, he thinks Kant sustains this, and it's in different levels, right? Like, it's the way that the object is for you both is for the subject is both a thing in itself and an appearance, right? It's like both at one at the same time. It's way the way in which the subject is a theoretical being and a practical being at the same time, but they don't exactly overlap, right? And so for Kant, that's absolutely crucial to his philosophy. That has to be true. So you have to be, and so I once was in a thesis defense with an analytic philosopher who's a complete determinist. And I said, well, Kant's idea is that we're practically free, but not theoretically. And this guy's just, I don't know what that means, practically free. That doesn't make any sense to me. And Caratani would say, you're right, it doesn't make any sense. That's why it's a great idea. Because the point is that there's this overlap that can't be, it can't be reduced to sense, right, between the two. Mm-hmm. And they're both operative, but you can't prioritize one over the other. And that's for him what the parallax gap is, and it's a gap within subjectivity, right? Like that's the Kantian, and Slavoj will talk here about the Kantian transcendental, right? Like, and that's what he means, right? Just that idea of subjectivity that has that determines or shapes the world that it encounters. But Caratani's point is it doesn't shape it totally, it shapes it with this gap, right? So that's, that I think is really good, but why... I think you were right in what you said, that there has, that affair can't be, I mean, it's consummated, but it can't turn into a second alternative marriage because, and I think this is incredible point by him that what Caratani sees is just on the side of the subject, Hegel shows is also a parallax in the object itself, that if there's not a divide in being, then subjectivity itself couldn't even emerge. And I think that's that inability to explain that divide. And then he spends a lot of time in his quarrel in this book with cognitive science. He spends a lot of time on this emergence of consciousness. And he has there's a critique of Daniel Dennett's consciousness. Daniel Dennett just died, by the way, like 3 or 4 days ago. Daniel Dennett's consciousness explained. There's a lot of engagement with Dennett and Damasio also, who wrote a book, The Critique of Descartes. I forget the exact title, but what he's trying to get at is that the emergence of consciousness has to occur, or can only be attributable to some equal parallax gap within objects themselves, right? Like that's what and that is not a step that Caratani is at all willing to make.
Okay. So let's do an elementary definition of parallax right now. Whenever I'd like to explain what, Zizek is on about in this book. So you stick your thumb, so extend your arm all the way out in front of your face, except if you are Paul Eisenstein and driving right now. My God, don't do this. So you stick your thumb like all the way as far as you can in front of your face, and you look, close one eye and look at it, and then look at it with the other eye, and go back and forth, you know, quickly as possible. And what you'll see, I mean, like I remember being a kid and being fascinated by this.
Because it moves.
Because it seems to move.
Yes.
And so
that's a Kantian parallax, isn't it?
No, okay. So we're going to, so that's
you're
an
gonna
elementary definition.
Okay,
we're going to, yeah. Okay. So, but the thing that we're noting here is that and I think this is the turn that Zizek puts on this idea, is that you can't have both positions at the same time. Like there's this non-coincidence. So we wouldn't say that when you look at your thumb with both eyes, if you're someone who can see things with two eyes or you know, you're not, I guess what would it be, farsighted? Probably be pretty difficult if you weren't wearing glasses, whatever. So like, it's just
if you're farsighted.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Farsighted. Right, yeah. Right. I know. Yeah. Right. It's hard to,
I know. It's all, I always get those backwards. Yeah.
Always get it backwards. Yeah. But, so there's a, it's, to go back to one of the places where we kind of started this string laying the seeds for it, like Wittgenstein's, duck, right. That also looks like a rabbit.
Yeah.
it is the idea, like when you have those images that are also two images, there's a couple things that happens. Is like one, once you see the second image, you can never go back to the way that you saw it before you knew there was another image.
Right, right.
Exactly. Right. And you also can't really see them both completely at the same time.
Right.
Like it's not really possible. And that's Zizek's point. That's his twist on that.
Yeah.
And is there, he says it a number of different times. It's very, very nice. Cause he comes back. It's one of the things that's so great about this book is that there is this very strong central thesis. I think this is why this book is so great, that he does come back to, because it is wonderful when he's elliptical and he goes off on different, tangential things. But like this always comes back to the idea of parallax, where like it's not just a shift in perspective from the viewer, but it's also is like a perspectival shift in the object itself as well. And he says that in so many words, like in a number of different places throughout. So that's the crucial thing. It's not just like that there are these two that can't be mediated, but it's that what you see is that it's actually that we can even apprehend it at all is because of this gap that is just riven through us and the object, and that this parallax gap is central to thinking subjectivity at all, and that this is something that we can think moving forward from a Hegelian position, but the Kantian position forces us to have to leave those gains behind. That's
right, because we remain on the side of the subject. Right, we remain on the side of the subject for Kant. Right, that's a great example, Ryan. I'm going to do another example just because this is my way. And so when this book came out, I emailed Slavoj, and I'm like, you know what? I just hope that this novelization is as good as the film, because I really love the film. And he wrote me back. He's like, no, it'll never surpass that film. But I actually think that it does. But that's the film I'd like to talk about as an example. So, Parallax View is it's 1975. It's by Alan Pakula, who made these paranoid thrillers in the 70s and up through the 90s, I think. And then he died pretty young. And this film stars Warren Beatty, who plays this guy Joe Frady. He's an investigative reporter, and his ex girlfriend is killed because she witnessed all the witnesses to this assassination are systematically killed. And one of them includes his ex-wife or ex-girlfriend. And that leads him, then he gets involved in the investigation, and then he tries to uncover what this conspiracy is that killed this. It's kind of like the Kennedy assassination, a sort of presidential candidate or a senator or something. And what's fascinating is that the film is really about this same kind of parallax, that you can either, you see the assassination plot, right? Or you see things as they seemingly normally are, right? But you can't see both things at once. And I think that's true of any kind of paranoid thinking about the world, right? Like you can either see from the perspective of the plot, or you see from the normal perspective, normal subjectivity, but you can't see both at the same time, which is why people that are on the inside of such kinds of paranoid thinking can't really talk to people that are on the outside, and vice versa. You're not even in the same, you're not seeing the same things because of this parallax break, I think. So, and I think that's one way. The other way that I was thinking of thinking about it is that Lacan says, when you experience the objet A, you either experience the objet A or you experience the visual field, right? So the objet A's gaze, right? So the example of the Hans Holbein's painting, The Ambassadors, there's this skull in the front, and you can only see it when you're up to the right and really close to the painting. And when you see the skull, you can't see the rest of the painting. But if you're looking at the rest of the painting, you can't see that it's a skull. So I think that's also, there's these two, both perspectives. I think this is the key, isn't it? The both perspectives are true. Right.
Right.
That it's not that, oh, one is true and one is false. And that's why, and I think Slavoj is going to try to come up with a politics in this book on the basis of that parallax. Like, can you do it? Where it's the gap itself that is the truth, not one side or the other.
Just really quickly on the gaze, did you catch that early in this book that he also has the translation from Sheridan as the picture is in my eye, but I am in the picture. Like he cites the Sheridan, but he
corrects it.
He corrects it. Yeah. I don't know if you, I'm trying to.
So he silently very corrects quick, it, but he doesn't.
He silently.
Point it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
I would make a big deal out of it. That's the difference.
Between yeah. Is, that's really funny. No, but yeah. Yeah, it's super good. I'm going to stop looking for it because it's distracting me. And I'm like, nobody wants to hear somebody read through a book while talking about something else.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about, is this a break for, so I'll introduce this and then I'll give you my thing. And then I want to hear you respond to it.
Okay.
Is this a break for Slavoj? Or was this anticipated by what came before this? Because for me, I think that this book is a bit of a break. And I think it's because of what Caratani wrote. And I think it pushed Žižek to really think about this idea. And I think it opened up. I mean, he's very complimentary to Caratani in this, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a, like, I think it would be wrong to read this, to be my thing, that Caratani is the jumping off point for, you know, Slavoj to say what he wants. Like, I think it's like, it's fully incorporated into this. And I think if he doesn't write that book, I don't think Slavoj writes this book.
I agree. And I think you're right to say that this book does mark a break, right? Like, it's really, I think he was struggling with this idea of Bartleby, what's a politics of Bartleby. And then I think, that the idea of parallax gave him a way into that, and that he could then develop it fully, right? Like that. I think that in a way that wouldn't be cynical, right? Like I think that the problem is it's very easy to read Bartleby. I think most people do as this cynical detachment, and I like this. Mm-hmm. I would prefer not to think that's wow. That means that how can that be a political act? And then the novelization of the Pakula film ends with precisely the challenges to imagine Bartleby in power, right? And I think that's like, can you imagine not the parallax as a anomaly or as a way of perceiving things, but as the dominant thing, right? Like, I think that's the, so I think you're right that it really represents a shift. I would also say that part of me, as I'm rereading this book, I taught it to students and to grad students. And I was like, before you came here, and I remember when I started reading it, I'm like, oh my God, they're going to never understand a word. It's going to be terrible. And they loved it. So I was totally wrong. And I underestimated their intelligence, but I think it's maybe the best one to teach because he has a clue. Of course, he can't help himself. Yes. There's a lot of tangents. There's even these interludes that have really, what they have to do with anything, God only knows. He just had some stuff he wanted to put in there. I mean, to be honest, that's what those interludes are. He's like, I have some analysis of Henry James. Can I just stick that in the book? Okay. For some reason, there was no editor saying, that's not a great idea. Don't get that out of there. There's no editor that can say that to him, I think, anymore.
That's true.
Yeah.
I think
it's too bad because I think I would like a book by him on Henry James. He also appreciates my favorite Henry James novel, The Princess Casamassima, which is, I think, criminally underrated. And the rest,
nice.
I am not a James person. Luckily, my colleague Dan Fogel, former president of UBM, does not listen to this podcast, so he will not hear me say that. He's a Henry James scholar. And he loves to come down to my office and chat about James, and I just chat him up. And he's like, you know, it's so great to have a colleague that really knows and likes James. I'm like, yeah, yeah, it's great. Yeah.
It would be.
It's great.
It would be, wouldn't it?
That's very good, man. So other than those, but here's my point. It's a backhanded compliment because I really think this is a very coherent, other than these little interludes and a couple of tangents, I think it's a very coherent, just as you're saying, it keeps coming back to the same idea. And it makes you kind of wish that he just wrote books like this, right? Like, I guess that's the same thing with your Dylan homology.
Yeah.
Right? Like
it's true.
You can't have the comeback album unless you have the other ones, right? Like
it's true. Yeah.
The borrowed kettle or whatever those other ones.
Yeah.
Are. Yeah.
Well, it's the meta Hegelian lesson of his oeuvre, right? That like I like to say this about television is that, you know, there's a lot of, you'll get a lot of, commentary on like individual seasons of like, you know, good shows or shows that people like validate as being good. And they're like, oh yeah, so the earlier episodes weren't so good, but the later ones are like, oh man, it's like, they're only good because of those ones you say you don't like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and it's not just as in comparison to, it's because there is work that those things are doing that are going to allow those later things to flourish. And it's hard to appreciate that in the linear trajectory of watching a series. Yeah. And I think it's hard to be, as an artist or as a theorist, like someone who's writing something, I think you can't be meta reflexive of that as you're writing books.
I mean, that's the parallax, right? Like that is exactly. The parallax. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. For sure. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the first thing that came to mind is Saul. I mean, I think the end of Better Call Saul is incredible. I think some of the early stuff is a little repetitive, but it's like all paving the way for that. So it couldn't be eliminated, I think.
So, absolutely. No, you can't. It's exactly. Like you can't have that. You can't have that stuff that is, I don't know, whatever. I don't like to go into the evaluation part of it, but just like the stuff that is lesser is the like, is the grounding of it, you know, like we often make I think we do this thing oftentimes with art, or I guess I think with like philosophy or whatever, where we say like, no, the groundwork is this other stuff that I think is really great. And it's not this other stuff that is like less good. It's like, no, something was being worked out there. But again, it's hard to appreciate that when you're reading straight through and you can't really be in control of that as you're doing it as the author either. So especially when there's a break, and I do eventually want to get back to the Bartleby thing, because I think it's really because the idea of like you put it nicely. So I'm going to just recapitulate that. But like parallax saves the idea of Bartleby from cynicism, because this was something I think I might've mentioned this like several episodes ago, but like the cynical idea of Bartleby is that's everyone's boss,
right?
Like, anywhere right. is just like, they don't do anything and you do more work. Right. And so then so the idea of a Bartleby in politics from that, it doesn't really work, because your boss is already doing less. So you're going to not do less. And so everyone is not, like, it doesn't seem as though that's going to add up. So it can't be that version of it can't be the cynical version of Bartleby in power, because that's Elon Musk.
Yeah,
like that's just like how is that different from where we are now? And it's absolutely not revelatory, and it's not emancipatory in the least bit.
Right.
So the idea that works, I think, if you follow it, is the Bartleby of parallax. And I think that so I haven't seen the film. So
you haven't seen Parallax View? It's a great movie.
No, I haven't seen it.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So that's going to be my lesson. We don't know if that's going to be everybody else's, but that's my lesson for this. But could you, because I just don't have the example, and I want to try to, before we do another, like other examples or whatever, but could you make that, Could you square that circle? The Bartleby of parallax, the parallax view, that whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I'm not sure that the film, because I don't want to say how the film ends, because this is a film where the end really matters. And I think what the film shows is, well, it's a paranoid thriller. So I think that that's so I think it can't do what you're asking it to do. I don't think the film can show, like, I think paranoid films don't, I mean, this is their fun. I love them. Like 3 Days of the Condor, everyone knows. I love that film. I could watch it almost monthly, and especially I watch it every Christmas. But that film is not about, I mean, maybe that film actually is, because it ends with that. Well, how far can you go if they won't print it, right? Like that it ends with the, although I just gave away the end of that film, but we've talked about it so much.
We talked about it before.
I feel like the problem with the paranoid thriller is that there is a solution because there's an other in charge, right? Like I think those films don't envision the other as castrated. Like
totally true.
Don't you think? And that's the problem. Like the other can really work behind, because only because the other is behind the scenes, right? Like anytime you're not, and that's why QAnon has to remain behind the scenes, right? Like if you come into the light, then your castration becomes evident, right? Like you can't avoid it. And so I think that's why these conspiracy paranoid films have to keep the conspiracy hidden. I mean, 3 Days of Condor, I think, doesn't really do that, because I think we come to grasp what the conspiracy is, right? And so I think that's a little, I think that's why that's the great film of that genre. Although you could argue there's this other one called Rollover. Have you seen that one?
Okay.
It's also by Alan Pakula. It's an incredible film because it's really about, our whole economy depends upon the Saudi Arabians. This is fascinating. Rolling over their investment in the American economy. And they just say, one time they just don't do it. And then there's a total economic collapse. And the film really then tries to depict almost a kind of utopia after the economic collapse. So it's a very, very interesting paranoid film. But anyway, I guess, so I don't have a way to square the circle of like means like Bartleby.
You're right. No. I mean, you're right, because it can't work in that genre, because as you just said, it's like you can't do this. You just can't do this thing where it's like, oh yeah, everyone is lacking and flawed and castrated except for the 12 people who are in control of the conspiracy. You know,
but Ryan, doesn't Slavoj give a filmic example? Like, isn't, and he's returning to his own example of Wild at Heart, David Lynch's Wild at Heart. Nice. And he talks about this scene where Bobby Peru, played by Willem Dafoe, forces, what's her name? It's played by Laura Dern, Lula. Mm-hmm. Lula, I think. Yeah. He doesn't. It's a sexual assault, right? But it's completely verbal, and he says is say fuck me, and then
right.
She finally, and it's very violent looking, although he doesn't constrain her physically, right? And then she does it. She says it, and Slavoj's point always was, and then he says, no, thank you. I don't have time today, but maybe some other time, right? And so it's kind of funny. And Slavoj always said, this just showed, like, it's a violence on the level of fantasy, which is worse than actual violence. But in this book, he twists his own example, right? And he says, actually, Bobby Peru is showing what, he's actually evincing politeness, right? Like that he's
interesting.
He's showing. Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, I think in a way, like, because he's not for, you know, he didn't force her to act on her fantasy, right? Like he allowed it to be articulated and it didn't act on it. And that like allowing that space is a kind of, I wonder if that's what he would mean by Bartleby in power. Like someone like Bobby Peru. I know no one would want him in power, but
nobody would want him in power.
I don't know. Something like that, though. Like that kind of, like, that's also the reason, don't you think, also fascinating, this the discussion of the difference between Stalinism and Nazism, right? Like that kind of, isn't he also there trying to say what Bartleby in power would look like. Not Stalin, obviously, mm-hmm. but the way in which there's still, like in the Nazi concentration camp, like the fact that everyone in the Stalinist camp undergoes trial, is forced to confess, and that mm-hmm. you couldn't imagine the same thing. Like Jews weren't forced to confess anything under the Nazis. Mm-hmm. They were just guilty. Right. And I think
there's a presupposition to criminality.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And communists were just guilty. They weren't, there's no trial. Whereas under Stalinism, there is this kind of minimum polite civility, right? Like I think Slavoj says the difference between civility and barbarism, right? Like that.
Right.
Too. Which is interesting because it is a total rejection of this totalitarian thesis, right? That they're both just totalitarism, same thing, right? Mm. He's just saying they're different. And I think what I'm getting at is I think Stalinism is a little closer, like that, just that little bit to Bartleby in power, right? Like
this is my thing on this. I find it interesting. And there's so much to talk about that, like, we could probably do multiple episodes. We'll probably come back to talk about this book at other times. I wanted to get the key features on this as it relates to this trajectory on Kant that we've been doing. And I think this is a crucial point about the Bartleby in power thing. And it's for me, this is a way of, an importantly different way of naming a castrated leader. That's how it makes the most amount of sense to me.
Yes. Yeah.
Is someone avowing their, like, so this kind of this double move, I you tell me if you think this is what he's getting at here, is this double move of someone who is avowing their fecklessness while also being in this position of authority.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to think about some examples as we talk about other aspects of this book, but that I thought was, I just thought that little twist is important because it's not
incredible.
Doing nothing, because that's what we have in contemporary capitalism, but it's kind of, I would say it's like avowing the nothing, if that.
I think so, Ryan. And I think, I think it's also not seeking a solution, right? Like, I think there's an incredible, I think, incredible discussion. So he wrote his first couple books in Slovene. They're not translated. And I don't think he would allow them to be translated. He wrote his first couple books on Heidegger. And there's an incredible discussion of Heidegger. I think it's in chapter 5, if I'm not mistaken. And it really is an acknowledgement of Heidegger's importance as a thinker, but then trying to wrestle with like what goes so wrong with him. Mm-hmm. And I think his idea is that, well, the problem with Heidegger is he couldn't stand dealing with the parallax in a way, mm-hmm. right? He doesn't say it mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. directly, but I think that's his point. And that he wanted a solution to it. Like he was like, mm-hmm. there's this problem of like modern, the technological world. And rather than just accept or address or deal with that, the castrated subjectivity that becomes mm-hmm. immediately apparent in that world, he tries to flee to some kind of solution, and that's what he looks for in Nazism, right? Like that's mm-hmm. what he thinks. Like mm-hmm. Nazism will save us from technological modernity, and that's mm-hmm. in a way. I mean. Slavoj has this great discussion that all through, he even points the exact paragraph in Being in Time where Heidegger goes awry. And there's all this stuff about individual Dasein and suffering your being towards death. And then there's a one paragraph where he like turns to the collect, like Dasein gets its destiny from the folk, really. Right. And so right then, like that's the turn. And Slavoj's point is that there's something unavoidable about that error because he's so ensconced in seeking a solution rather than the Bartleby position, which is mm-hmm, he would prefer not. And I think you're so right to say, God, that's everyone's boss. They would prefer not, while you do. Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's important to make that I would prefer not universal and not just, and how do you think that as a positive injunction and not just a negative one? I think that's really that's what his challenge he's posed to himself.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I mean, this is why this comes to the, like, if we were, I said this to you before we started, if we were a cuter podcast, every episode would be called Why Something Else.
Right.
So this would be Why Parallax.
Why Parallax.
And Why Parallax. And so the one word answer to that is freedom. This is in our take. This is us telling you, this is Zizek's take. This is what's in this book is that parallax. And it goes back to what you were talking about with the sections in this that, provide a kind of a counter to cognitive science and evolutionary accounts of the brain, the body, like the whole thing. Is parallax is where we can locate the possibility of the kind of human freedom that we can actually have, which is how subjectivity, we were talking about this before, how subjectivity emerges and recreates its own past.
Yeah.
Or I would say, you know, there's even like, what is it? This guy, a friend of mine, likes a lot this, guy, Robert Sapolsky, who's this, he's a neuroscientist. Who after studying the brain, and I really like that this is the claim that he comes to, is that like, he can't say for sure that he can see free will in the brain, but he thinks that there's free won't, which I kind of like. I almost like that better. And I don't think I'm not going to draw the positions completely, because I don't know his work nearly well enough to be able to do this, but I think you can see this idea. So it's not in the, like, where we're going after from the perspective of a scientific idea of like, where is there free will in the brain? Where is there free will in biology? Where is there free will in evolution? Where is it in cognitive science? Is coming at the question from the wrong angle. It has to come from this, from a parallactic view,
right?
Where we're not like, sure. Yes. Like I'll just like, you know, say it this way. Like, I will allow, of course, like someone who is an expert in this thing that I don't barely understand to tell me that, like, look, there is determinism in cellular structure.
Right.
Like I will accept that completely. The thing that I think this is where Zizek is, I think this is where we are. And this is, I think, what this idea is like, we don't experience life or thinking the way that our cells do. And that's this parallax gap, right? Is that like, it's a, you know, I love this thing, you know, like David Bordwell, who died recently, you know, so I'm not going to be like,
I'm not going to slaughter this guy's thinking.
Well, yeah, maybe. I mean, although he was very mean to Joan and Prince.
He was a mean guy.
I always carry that. Yeah. Right. So, but
he paid Slavoj back for being nice to him. That's the problem.
You're nice to someone.
Well, that's how they pay you back, man. It's nice to one of your theoretical opponents. That is the way they pay you back. I found that to be true.
That's pretty funny. And his cognitive film theory account, like, so there's, I forget, I wrote this in when I was at UVM, my master's thesis. He was really invested in Torben Grodel's system of, I think it's called the PECMA system, of like how images make sense in the brain, like cognitive, like they follow this path of, I forget what all the ones stand for, perception or whatever. And it's for Bordwell, this is really revelatory and you know, this it buttresses everything that cognitivist film theory is doing and says, and that we should be going in this direction. And for him, this is like this, like kind of a further death knell of these theoretical approaches that, you know, you and I prefer, of course. The The problem is that like, look, like again, I will completely, someone tells me that's how the images go through the brain. They go through a system. It starts in your, you make sense in your, it's, you would think it's your occipital lobe, but actually it's in your frontal or something, whatever. Yeah, like yeah, if someone yeah. wants to tell me that, I believe it, but yeah. I don't comprehend it that way. No one has ever looked at something and has been like, oh, I believe my apprehension of what I'm looking at is now in this part of my brain. We can't live like that's not how we live. Right. It doesn't work that way. So there are these processes that our body does that sure I'll grant a deterministic flavor to those things, but then there's how are we situated to those processes, and that I think is just a really wonderful answer that Zizek's able to come up with parallax and like to sort of buttress the idea of subjectivity is that like if we were completely like flatly one-to-one subjected to experience in the world the way that our bodily systems like the way they handle them. I almost think, is there any reason to speak to anybody? Wouldn't we all know what we're going through all the time? It would just be like, it would just be one-to-one. That's how the world is. Like, oh, my nervous system's supposed to do this or it's not working well. So it's doing this thing. And like, and that's it. But it's like, no, like when something happens to us, we don't experience it in the way that our body, like it could be a perfectly to our body, a normal or regular way of experiencing something, but not to us as in the us that speaks and thinks about it. It's like a complete rupture or interruption. And it's both of those things at the same time. There are those systems. That's how they work. Again, I'll grant the determinist flavor like to a certain extent, of course.
Yeah.
But then there is how we are situated in conscious and unconscious experience and how we're subjected to that and how we work relative to these things that operate on our behalf that we have, that they're just automatic.
Right.
And the only way you can be positioned to those things, I think this is Zizek's point, the only way we can actually talk about these things is to have this parallax position where, you know, I know that my body is doing my breathing for me and that's happening. And now I'm going to think about it. So I'm going to think about my breathing for the next, I don't know how long until it becomes an automatic thing again.
Yeah.
But it's like that, the idea, see, it's already happening, but the, like, I don't stop breathing because I'm thinking about it. But when I do think about it, it becomes weird. And I don't know where that is in my body. I don't know where that is like predictable and according to evolutionary thought or whatever. It's just like this idea of the to maybe make it a hokey phrase, but the minimal difference making all the difference.
Yeah,
is I think something that Slavoj explores in this book. I think to really great effect, especially when you start thinking about subjectivity in the age of like, of course, increased scientific knowledge about things. And there is an impulse generally, I think to want to find the answers for why are we the way that we are.
Right.
And that makes perfect sense. And science has, you know, since Sartre, I would say has become the site for that answer more so than, you know, philosophers and philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
And what we lose though is that like it is our reaction to our bodily reactions. That is that's how I understand the
freedom. Right. No, that's exactly right, Ryan. Right. Exactly right. Like freedom is for him the interruption, not just the inner impulse. Right. He says this is on, I think it's on, oh yeah, here I have it. It's on 202. He says, at its most elementary, freedom is not the freedom to do just as you like, that is to follow your inclinations without any externally imposed constraints, but to do what you do not want to do, to thwart the spontaneous realization of an impulse, an impetus. And I think that's exactly what you're saying, right? Like it's that interruption and how you relate to the impulse, right? Like it's not, like you don't just, the impulse isn't just directly experienced. you relate to the impulse. And that's what he also calls death drive here, right? Like that's his name for this, like this dislodging of you from your immediate impulse, right? Like you can't, it comes back to that thing we started with, the hi, how are you, right? Like the, you don't, there's not this immediate thing, like you're dislodged from that initially.
And
that's what it means to be a free speaking being. I like what you said about Sartre. I mean, it's a really interesting point that the public intellectual today is not Jean-Paul Sartre. It's Steven Pinker, right? I think there's a real shift in that way. Like we think Pinker has, he has the solution in a certain way, in a way that somebody talking about freedom doesn't, right? So I think, I think that's important. No. I also think, I just wanted to touch on this because I think, like what makes that freedom possible for him is, or what's the barrier to it, I think, is some image of the other's purity, right? And I think this I think leads up to the Bartleby and Power idea too, right? That like that, in a way, that's getting rid of this image of the other's purity. Like we have to sacrifice that image in order to accede to what he would call freedom or emancipation, right? Like I think, like he uses this example. Like he talks about belief, right? Like that that we need to imagine, we don't believe ourselves, but we imagine someone else who truly believes, right? Like that's the role that the fundamentalist plays in liberal capitalist society. That those are people, like we're not the lunatics who really believe, but those are the lunatics who really believe.
Right.
And I think that his point is really, no, what we need is our own belief in our own freedom. And as long as you think you attribute somewhere externally this real belief, then you can't believe on your own behalf, right? Like you can't. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's his, in a way, that's another part of his response to contemporary cynicism.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting to think about, you know, because I'm always on about this. About
I know
the,
you
the cynical
are.
Thing.
I know.
Yeah, and I hadn't, until we were doing this, I hadn't thought about parallax as the antidote, but it's a good answer, and I think pretty crucial, because like there's, I think the cynical position, a lot of the things that sustain it is, it's this idea that there are other people for whom there is a full coinciding, like a complete coincidence, between the, like the subject and themselves.
Yeah.
Like those are the people who have what? Like, I don't know, authority, money, control, whatever the thing
enjoyment,
is.
Enjoyment, whatever you call it.
Enjoyment. Yeah. They've got everything. They're fully coincide with each other. And I think the Bartleby of Parallax, which, and this is why I think it's important, is because it's easier to imagine, like a more famous or like worth talking about figure in literature that could be more cynical. I don't think that you're finding someone except for like Bartleby.
Yeah, Bartleby, you know,
and
right,
I think to rescue that position from cynicism by like, just like, no, he has to be read in this parallax view way. And it's also kind of like one forgets that the, you know, it's one of those things, I think this happens a lot where, there are really famous lines in things that overwhelm the thing itself, to maybe speak not in Kantian way. Yeah. But that thing goes against that line. But because the line is so good, we forget that. I'll just think about, like, there's a couple, the one that always comes up for me is the film High Fidelity, where the character in the middle of the film, Rob, is talking about dating people. And he says that, like, it's what you like, not what you are like, that matters. And he said, call me shallow, but it's the fucking truth. Everybody loves this line from this movie. They're like, oh yeah, that entire movie is about how that guy moves off of that position. That's what the entire rest of the film is about.
Right.
And there's all kinds of stuff. Like if I had time to stop and write it down before I was talking about this, that like the people, like it's kind of my thing also with 1984, George Orwell. It's like, no. That book is not about how terrifying and over, like an oppressive, like a government is that spies into everything. It's about how loving that is the terrifying thing, like finding comfort in that. Yeah. That's the last line of the book. And like everyone forgets this. He loved Big Brother. And it's not because he was brainwashed. It's because, like, that's, I think the more terrifying way to read that, the more, the way of reading that with more juice is that, again, finding the like the absolute comfort, finding the freedom in that kind of oppression. That's what the terrifying thing is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in a similar way, it's like, oh yeah, I'd prefer not to. The way sometimes people talk about Bartleby, like no one actually says this, but the way people is like Bartleby's telling the story himself, but he's not.
I know.
It's someone talking about Bartleby, right? It's that there's
frustrated
speaker,
with him.
Yes. And it's, and it's like, that is completely eliminated in any, whenever we talk about it. But I think that idea of the Bartleby of Parallax, like it redeems that aspect of the text. And I think it makes it, again, there's more juice to it. And it's like, you have to include also the frustration with that figure in trying to think alongside it as a radical, potentially like a radical political.
Yeah, I think absolutely position. True. Absolutely true. Yeah. Because if you don't do that, then you're really, then it's too rosy, right? Like it's, Bartleby in power. Wouldn't that be great? No, it's frustrating, right? Like I think
there's not a full coincidence. That's my point. Like,
right,
there's not
exactly,
that full coincidence.
Exactly. And then I thought that in a way, his reading of the Matrix trilogy was akin to his reading of Bartleby, right? Like I think he's saying the problem with Matrix trilogy is that the Wachowskis couldn't theorize Bartleby within the universe of the Matrix. Right, like the first, he thinks, the first film masterpiece. Right, like I think he maybe gives it too much credit, but what he loves about it is that it understands why the Matrix require. This is his best point about the film, and it's a great point that the Matrix require. Why does it require humanity to power it? Like what? Why that seems dumb, like their energy? No, but he says it's like their enjoyment, it's their jouissance. Like that's what powers the Matrix. And then it can't, the film, the subsequent two films, I think he's right, the second one is slightly lesser and then the third one is a total disaster. And he has a lot of
I've got a hot take for you at the end of this.
Okay, you're gonna tell me why I'm totally wrong.
No. You don't know that. I could be saying anything. I could be saying almost anything.
All right. Okay. Okay. All right. I await it.
Okay.
With bated breath. But what I can't imagine is a response like Bartleby, and what Bartleby's withholding isn't, and I think this is a key way to read him, isn't work. But he's withholding his enjoyment or his jouissance.
Nice.
Right? And that's the real, I think Slavoj's saying, like, that's the real part three of the Matrix. Like this, like, can we refuse to give the Matrix our jouissance? And then that was the really radical act. And then that becomes, like, how to imagine that in power without that demand for enjoyment, right? I think that's, I think that's what he's getting at. Anyway, let's hear it.
Okay, so now I want to be clear. In terms of evaluation, I agree. I think I like the first film, great. The second film, less good. Third film, an evaluative position. But I'm trying to be, you know, consistent with my own theoretical leanings. I don't think that matters, and I like the movies. I like the movies less as they go on, and the fourth one that they made for HBO, I think is pointless.
Okay,
but I
haven't even
with
seen
the
it.
Three,
I heard it was so bad.
No, it's fine. But I actually think theoretically, the films get more interesting.
Okay, let's hear it.
On this.
Okay.
I think it goes like this. I think that just going back years, I think the Matrix trilogy maps on really nicely to my triangle, dualism, multiplicity, dialectics.
Okay.
The first film is about the finding of the one, Neo. He's the one. He's the good guy. There's the bad guy. He's going to have all this like complete power to take this thing down.
Yeah.
That's what it does theoretically.
So it's dualistic.
The second film, it's completely dualistic.
Yeah, gotcha.
Okay. There's gotcha. Smith. Okay.
Yeah.
The second film gets into like, oh, yeah, you're the one, but like for right now.
Right.
Because this has happened before. This has actually happened a lot. And you're not the first one to come, you know, when he goes to see the architect
yeah.
in this scene that I really don't like. But theoretically what it's doing is this like, look, you're part of this multiplicity. Why are you any better or more revelatory than any of the other ones who have come through here? You're really not. Like, and I think it makes this nice theoretical point. Okay. Neo is now, he's just another in this string
right.
and there are just like a million Mr. Smiths and there's just, so what makes him any different or any better?
So multiplicity.
There is something else. Yeah. It's just, so the multiplicity like is, it's all, there's this co-equal flattening with all the multiplicity
gotcha.
And nothing is interesting or special. No one is more special or more powerful than anyone else. Something else is needed to actually move forward. And where I think Matrix Revolutions ends is on this idea of existing within this fabricated paradise, but sustaining precisely the tension that would overturn the world, but keeping that within it. And that's that final scene where it's the Oracle and the girl on the bench.
Oh.
And that's how I have resisted it because I do not like these movies.
Yeah.
But the more that I thought about it, I thought I could see it.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's
really good. Yeah. 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 I've actually kind of soured even on the first one. Like
okay.
Yeah, I just, but I like what you're saying there. I mean, that's very good as a reading.
It's more than that. Again, I don't like them,
yeah.
but I think to be fair, it doesn't like, I think every once in a while you should be able to do this to find the, like, you know, find the thing that's, I hated seeing it. Like I was making notes for potentially for writing that book or whatever that is going to be. I was like, God damn it. The Matrix is actually this. And the worst movie is the thing that I want to say is the best thing. And
well, that's great because that's how Slavoj starts the parallax, right?
Like
his very starting point in the fundamental parallax for him is this parallax between great radical art and radical politics. And he makes this point that like the Leninist prefers, most Leninists prefer classical art and it's mm-hmm. the fascists who prefer the great works of modern art. Right. And I think, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's totally true, but Ezra Pound was a fascist. I mean, and you know, so there is some truth to that. I think that, modernism isn't, I think a lot of people have tried to make that marriage work, right? Like people have given it a lot of effort. You know how the marriage counselor says, let's just work on this marriage. And I think a lot of people have worked on it. Like Bertolt Brecht worked on it. Walter Benjamin worked on it. Theodor Adorno worked on it. Herbert Marcuse, like these, mostly Frankfurt School, obviously. They spent a lot of time working on that marriage. And they just, mm-hmm. I don't think they, and I think Slavoj's point is they couldn't make it work because there's this, exactly what you're saying, like sometimes the better political thing is in the weaker work of art. And there's no correlation necessarily between a radical aesthetics and a great radical political idea. I think that's what I have to say, of all the ideas in here, I resist that one the most. I do not like that idea. I don't know if I'm right, but I really hope that that's not true because I'm very invested in the modernist art project. And I also obviously believe that it's part of an emancipatory project politically as well. Mm. So that.
As do I.
Yeah.
I know you, although, people may not know this. Todd's degrees in modernist literature.
That's true.
From way back when.
Yeah.
Although you rejected a lot of but you love Woolf, right?
I love Virginia Woolf. Yeah, love Virginia. Okay. In fact, I'm teaching a class in the fall with Mrs. Dalloway as the central one of the central texts. And I think Absalom, and maybe Passing or something. I don't know.
Passing. Yeah, Passing's great.
Yeah. So I would do Their Eyes Are Watching God, but I've read it way too many times. So I can't subject myself to that. not that it's not a great, it's a great book, but I wrote that book you're talking about. It was one of the chapters on Their Eyes Are Watching God. So.
Right. Sometimes we can't go back to the
Go back again. That's another great modernist novel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thomas Wolfe.
That's right. Yeah.
Can't go home.
That's the lesson. I also think that's what you can't go home. I also think that's part of what led me to the Matrix trilogy thing. It was like, no, now because I realized I have to watch the last film again, like multiple times if I'm going to like actually write about it.
Wow. So the lesson. Interesting. Yeah. So
my God, I can't believe it. You're going to do this to me. You son of a bitch. Okay,
no,
ahead,
it's just interesting because we have a great film to choose from. And we're going to choose a terrible film. But I think that is, Ryan, what is the lesson?
The lesson is watch Matrix Revolutions.
Okay.
Whatever.
With that, a very tepid endorsement, but.
Yeah,
whatever. Some other time.
Stab a fork in your thigh.
Some other time we will recommend Parallax View.
Another time.
All right. Over and out, Ryan.
Over and out, Todd.